I haven't read Frank Herbert's Dune, nor have I seen the recent movie, but scenes from the cult David Lynch film are, however, imprinted on my mind. And I'm not just talking about Sting in his underpants. I'm referring, of course, to the Litany Against Fear, a poetic mantra recited by the Bene Gesserit, and it goes like this. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me, and when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. Who is this I that remains when the fear has gone? Maybe somewhat tangentially, this makes me think of the words of Pema Chodron. Only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible in us be found. This fearless I, this indestructible intrinsic self, could this be who we really are when we strip away all that we have accumulated, all that we cling to, all that our ego desperately holds on to give itself substance in this chaotic world of expectation that we've created for ourselves? Muji famously asked us to step into the fire of self-discovery, claiming that this fire will not burn you, it will burn only what you are not, and set your heart free. This is Conversations on Living, a podcast about how to be well, do well, and live well. I'm Chris Brock, and today I'm stoking those fires of self-discovery and getting ready to annihilate everything that I am not with the hope of discovering the indestructible I, as I talk to Kevin Krinitsky, author of the forthcoming book, The Still Point. The premise is this: life gets better, easier, and flows with less resistance when we stop fighting it, and instead come to it only as it is, and not with all the stories we've attached to it. And furthermore, we get better when we come to it only as we are, and not with all the trappings of emotion, anxiety, worry, and ego. The still point of who we are and where we are, as Pema Chodron might say, that part of us which is indestructible. You can find out more about Kevin at his website, which is www.authorkevinkrinitsky.com. And before we get into this conversation, just a word about Headliner. Headliner is the app that I use to create those audiograms with which I market this podcast. You've probably seen them, little audio snippets with captions or a waveform. And Headliner is definitely the easiest and most powerful way to create them. So if you host a podcast and you are interested in creating these kind of things, then check them out at headliner.app. And also a word about Plane. Plane is a game created by friend of the podcast, Krish Srikumar, and it's a meditation game. So you follow a fox along and you create a beautiful island. You grow trees, you grow plants, and you bring this island to life using the power of mindfulness. It's a great way to discover simple meditative and mindfulness techniques, as well as some simple relaxation techniques as well. So check it out at plane.co. That's playne.co. And now, without any further ado, here's that conversation with the author, Kevin Krinitsky, about The Still Point. Kevin Krinitsky, thank you for coming on the podcast. How's your day going? Has it got off to a good start?
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you.
Fantastic. And you are the author of The Still Point, which is, the subtitle is The Simplicity of Spiritual Enlightenment. And I know the idea of spiritual enlightenment makes some people run for the hills because it sounds a little bit kind of, I don't know, I hate to use the word woo-woo, but I think, you know, we are essentially spiritual beings, whether you're religious or not, whether you kind of have any kind of spiritual practice. The very energy that we bring to life is kind of our spirit with which we live our lives. And this whole idea of spiritual enlightenment is something that is kind of wrapped up in all kinds of different meanings and perspectives and ideologies and all this kind of stuff. But your kind of message is very simple, that we're living our lives filled with anxiety and worry and all of these kind of things that kind of go along with a Western existence where we have to pay the bills. But that's not our natural state, is it? That our natural state is actually one of peace and calm and happiness. And that in order to find that peace and calm and happiness, we need to align with who we really are, which I think would be great to get into in a little bit. But first of all, I'd like to kind of know a little bit more about you and your story and how you came to write this book, So I'll leave it over to you if that's okay.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. You know, I would say that in a nutshell, it was a lifetime of suffering, and a recognition at a certain point that that was something that was my responsibility. You know, something that it wasn't being imposed on me from the outside. It was a choice. And about 6 years ago or so, a decision was made to kind of turn away from the world. It kind of had reached this crescendo point where these matters had interested me very greatly. And it became clear that I needed to turn away from the world for a while. And that happened. And early on in that period, I was just sitting one day quietly, sitting in meditation, and a thought came up that, you know, the book would be written and it would be called The Still Point. And I had probably woken up the next day and said, okay, let's write the book. And of course, nothing came. But, you know, years went by. Years went by really as this simple practice of abiding as in and as our true nature. And about 4 years later or so, you know, the book started to come. So in a nutshell, that was how the book was written.
So you talk about this kind of lifetime of suffering. Are you just talking about a kind of the Western existential crisis that we're all chasing something that doesn't necessarily exist in mm-hmm. order to feel fulfilled and happy? Or was this something much more kind of personal for you, kind of a crisis point that built up over time and then you finally said enough is enough?
You know, I had I had anxiety that kind of waxed and waned since childhood. And about 15 years ago or so, I met my now wife. And in meeting her, I call this kind of the path of relationship, but in meeting her, there was a very strong recognition that we both had. And that led to a very intense relationship that quickly also became very confrontational, you know, very, very much two individuals with very strong egos and ideas as to how they wanted things to be. And it created this somewhat perfect storm of an inescapable situation of someone who seemingly, you know, I couldn't live without, she couldn't live without me. And yet we would, you know, be in almost constant conflict. And that, you know, initially led to, we both started, the Course in Miracles came our way. We both started to do the Course in Miracles. And there were some, you know, some gains made in that. But, you know, even after a decade or so of doing that, it was still very, very, there was still a lot of conflict and a lot of suffering. And it became clear there was enough intuition from that decade that it just became clear that the only way forward was that the conditioned ego structures would have to drop away, or you know, we would kill each other or something along those lines, you know, and that then culminated in that period of stepping away from the world to, you know, together. She actually had kind of led the way in making some gains. I was still working a very full-time you know, full-time job and a full-time life. And, you know, after that point, we moved into relative isolation and really began to, investigate this, you know, much more closely.
So it sounds a lot like, you know, you had to choose between, being kind and being right. Do you know what I mean? It was that kind of, I went through a kind of similar experience where I was so uptight about everything all the time. And in the end, I had to just start kind of saying almost like a mantra, let it go, just let it go, let it go, just muttering it under my breath. And then eventually, after doing this for weeks and weeks, I kind of suddenly found like, oh, I've let it go. And actually things are much, much better now. You know, this whole kind of yearning to be right. And Byron, I don't know if you know Byron Katie, but she talks about, there's a quote that she says where When I fight with reality, I lose, but only 100% of the time. And it's that to me feels like our kind of our root of suffering, this kind of fighting against what is, and whether it's in a relationship or whether it's our situation or whether it's just the state of the world, we're kind of constantly fighting against things that are, you talked about kind of almost like the immovable object and the irresistible force coming together, And I mean, was there a particular pain point? Was it a gradual acceptance that this is never going to change, so I need to change?
Yeah, I think it. I think it was. It was gradual. It was a gradual acceptance. I think that we bargain with the ego bargains. The ego wants to survive. The ego wants to wake up. The ego believes it can be liberated. And of course, it's simply a mistaken belief. Once that's seen clearly, in a sense, the real work begins after that. Once it is seen clearly that the ego is simply doesn't exist, there is still decades, of course, of conditioning, and much like a freighter in the ocean, when you turn the engine off, that freighter is going to move for several miles before it stops. So, in a sense, that is the time when the true work begins in eliminating that conditioning of the ego.
And what did that work look like for you? Was it literally kind of removing yourself from your old situations, all the things that could trigger you or cause you to feel in a certain way or to respond in a certain way and to just get out of there?
In moving into relative isolation and just spending time examining and abiding as the still point, it eventually reveals its nature, which is both infinite and eternal. And all that means, of course, it's ever present. You recognize that our simple aware being has always been with us. We've called it I our entire life, and we can recognize this. We can go back to when we were, 5 years old, 10 years old, 15, 20. That sense of I has always been present. It doesn't come, it doesn't go. You eventually see that is the case. So, this ever-present nature of our true being is eternal, and also it lacks nothing. It's infinite in that it has no borders. It's really has no limitations to it. So the fear of lack, the fear of death go away when that is recognized. But also at that point, which is the point that is typically called liberation or enlightenment, or of course there's many, many words for it. Enlightenment is simply it is simply one word. That's very much when the true work of eliminating the conditioned habits of the ego begin. That's when there's a realignment of the way we feel, the way we experience, the way we relate, after that point. And that's something that is, is an ongoing process. But in terms of how that's done, it's very much in my case, in having in being here and having having my partner and working, it's an every moment type of engagement. You're measuring yourself every moment by the way you interact, and whether that interaction is in alignment with truth or whether it is more in alignment with the belief in being a separate self, which was the previous, the previous reality.
So it's kind of like becoming witness to yourself in a non-judgmental way, I suppose. Is that kind of one way of saying
Yeah,
it?
I mean, certainly judgment is not something that we, judgment is not, when the recognition of the still point as what we are essentially comes, and that further step of understanding its nature, it's both ever present and infinite nature. You see that it's open, it's completely accepting, it's incapable of judgment. And the work becomes aligning aligning the way you live to that. So certainly, it doesn't include judging. You know, it's simply not our function, so to speak, to judge.
So, I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing you might experience in a kind of a very good meditation session. You know, one of those meditation sessions where you really get in there and just for a moment you kind of connect with this kind of sense of awareness and nothing more, and your ego drops away and there's nothing left there apart from just this kind of sense of awareness. But how do you carry that through in daily life, especially here in the Western world where you're bombarded with kind of the news all the time, things to spend your money on that will make you happy if only you could afford all the down payments on them, the bills to pay, all of this kind of stuff. How do you not kind of end up just coming straight back into this kind of sense of anger, bitterness, discomfort with the world and your place in it straight away?
I think certain things fall away, like perhaps watching the news and, following things like that. But the idea is to recognize the simplicity of your true nature, which is the simple awareness that you and I have right now. I'm aware, I have a perception of you. I hear you speaking. This simple awareness is the most obvious reality that we have. It's very intimate, yet we give our attention continually to just about everything but that. We give our attention to experience. We're much more interested in our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions of the world, etc. So it's obscured. This ever-present true nature is obscured. And I think that's why in the book so often I direct people back to the recognition of their very own awareness. And that is what is called the direct path. We go directly to what we are. And then when that is recognized or glimpsed, and as you mentioned, it's something that many, many people certainly on this planet have had that experience. It becomes the simple practice of going back to it over and over again and abiding in that as that. Because again, this is not you abiding as that. This is your true nature. This is what you have called I your entire life. And as you abide in that over and over again, certainly sometimes when you're sitting quietly in what you call meditation, or even in the midst of the world, of experience, of any type of experience, you go back to that which knows your experience and you abide as that. And it then begins, you begin to get that separation between what you are and the experiences that you're having. That's how over time the mind becomes reconditioned to live as that.
How do we know when we've actually found our kind of true self, our kind of intrinsic self that you're talking about, and not just another representation of the ego? There is always a, many people when they go on the kind of path of self-discovery or self-improvement or something like that, they have an idea of who they would like to be. But how do they know it's not just a kind of another act or another kind of another version of their ego personality, and it is actually the kind of original core sense of self?
If you ask yourself the question right now, am I aware? What is the answer?
Yes. Yeah.
See, you paused and then you said yes. In that pause, you went to the felt sense of being aware. This is not something intellectual. It's like when you, if you stepped on your cat's tail and the cat cries out, the cat doesn't intellectualize, am I in pain? It's known. Yeah. Just like you knew you were aware. In that very instant, you're aware of being aware. That isn't the ego. That's your true nature.
So, in order to get there, we have to let go. We have to let go of everything we think about a situation.
You just did it in,
yeah.
You did it without doing anything. You asked yourself the question, am I aware? And you said, yes, there was no hesitation. There was no, you know, intellectualizing whether or not you were aware. You are aware and you recognize that instantly without the mind being engaged. That's your true nature. That's the true nature of all.
I mean, all day long we're being a kind of attention is being weaponized against us, if you like, and our judgment and our attention. You know, you've got the news media telling us what to be angry about. You know, this is important. Pay attention here. You know, there are, you know, gym, especially at this time of year, beginning of January, you've got gym memberships saying, hey, fatty, you know, you're never going to be a good person unless you join our gym. And you're like, yeah, I'm a terrible person. Oh, gosh, I've eaten too many pies over Christmas, you know, and also I need to buy that holiday because otherwise I'll never be happy and I need that car. How can we, I mean, is it literally just a matter of practice and practice to kind of just let go of all of this stuff and to just kind of walk as if we're bulletproof through the world as it is designed to kind of distract us from this?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that what you are can't be practiced, right? You can't take, you can't move towards yourself. You're already there. As you just recognized when you asked yourself the question, am I aware? Yes. So, you know, that is not a practice. That's a timeless instant, a timeless recognition. Abiding as that, whether you call it, you know, formal meditation and you sit down and you ask yourself the question, am I aware? And then you abide as that awareness over and over again. You know, that seems to be a practice for the mind, and it's a practice that, you know, that should be undertaken. So yes, this is the, if you will, the distancing and the separation between that simple awareness that you are and everything you're aware of. Because again, we have been programmed to give almost exclusive attention to everything we are aware of, all of the things you're talking about, but even our thoughts, you know, our thoughts and our feelings, which simply arise in our awareness, we give them identity. We put our identity, who we are, we put that identity in our thoughts and our feelings and in the body. And ultimately, of course, we are putting our identity in that which is ephemeral, things that come and go. And we wonder why we're anxious. We wonder why we're depressed. We wonder why, you know, yeah. So, yes.
I mean, are we, in order to maintain this kind of sense of just being aware and to not just be aware in the moment, but to be aware going forward and to keep asking that question, do we need to, is it required that we make shifts in our lives? So if there are things that kind of pull us out of that and, you know, and our response to those things is unhappiness, for example, or stress, are we, you know, is it a requirement that we kind of actually say, this thing is preventing me, this situation is preventing me from aligning with my true self, it's preventing me from letting go, so I need to shift to somewhere else. You know, this, my job is preventing me from doing this, the news that I watch is preventing me from doing this. How can we, is it a matter of kind of making big shifts in our lives to allow this to happen?
Your awareness and the awareness of any sentient being is available at any time, under any circumstance, regardless of any experience that you may or may not be having, whether it's pleasant, whether it's unpleasant, it's always available. It is always available. Otherwise, experience wouldn't be possible. You know, awareness is your true nature, is already present for any experience to arise within it. So ultimately, no, you know, ultimately, no. However, is it possible that shifts will occur? Absolutely, you know, absolutely they may occur, and circumstances may change, and you know, certain people may turn away from certain things as this becomes something that begins to colonize their interests, so to speak, for whatever reasons. But it's important to recognize that what you are always and already aware. You are always already the self-aware still point, regardless of what your circumstances are on the outside.
So, I mean, it's just the practice, I guess, then is to just connect with that awareness. So to kind of say I'm, so when you're unhappy, kind of say, I'm aware I'm unhappy, and I'm going to connect to that kind of still point of awareness.
Yeah, it's to shift the attention from the emotion or the feeling of being unhappy to what is it that knows that. And that is a that is the same as asking yourself the question, am I aware? But in the midst of experience, when we're having an experience, we can say, what is it that knows this experience? And that is your aware being. It's utterly changeless. And again, abiding as that over time begins to reveal its qualities, if you will, its inherent qualities.
So abiding by this continually, this kind of sense of being aware, this sense of kind of being a field of awareness, if you like, does that disconnect you from experience? Do you find that you're kind of experiencing life but one step removed, because you're constantly, there's this kind of constant, I'm not experiencing it, I'm aware I'm experiencing it. You know what I mean?
The final the final step, or if you will, the recognition that there is nothing to experience but this self-aware still point vibrating within itself. In other words, it's the vibration, if you will. Experience is nothing but the vibration of this awareness within itself. So there is absolutely no removal from experience. Experience, certainly the nature of the still point and your true nature, which is its peace and its happiness itself. It isn't joy, or it isn't it's happiness itself, and that life becomes more peaceful and more happy. Experience is experienced in the same way, as you don't lose experience, or you're not distanced from experience in any way.
So what happens to things like fear and desire? And I mean, do you find that, like, I had a conversation with Tom Cronin, who's an Australian, quite a well-known Australian meditator, and he was talking about, we have this urge to fill a hole, but when we, we're buying things, we're consuming things because we feel like it'll make us complete. But when we actually connect with who we are, we realize there is no hole. And so everything, all of these kind of things, this desire for more stuff, or all these things that are supposed to make us happy, whatever, actually becomes a kind of futile exercise that just leaves us more and more hungry, if you like, because there is no hole to fill. But I mean, what do we, I mean, does our kind of place in the modern world fall away? Do we become more and more kind of living more and more simplistic lives, because we no longer, our desires are no longer, our desires for kind of material comforts, for example, are no longer valid in a way, because we're aware of them, but we're not kind of, in their being, having those desires, but we're aware of the desires, but we're aware of the kind of emotions and the experiences.
Yeah, I mean, your desire, there is still desire, but the desire is no longer moving towards a hope of completion. It's coming from being complete. It's a celebration, basically. It's a celebration of love. It's no longer moving towards love. It's in love. And life is lived very much like that. It's there are there are, without a doubt, shifts that occur, and in terms of that, that cloying, the cloyingness, so to speak, will gradually dissipate. But again, it's replaced. It's replaced by being, seated in love and moving towards. If you move towards anything, it's really to celebrate that newfound, you know, recognition and realignment.
Can we still be effective in the kind of obligations of our days, you know, effective in our office jobs, 9 to 5, effective in, you know, being present in a kind of unjust world when we are coming from this kind of serene space of love and awareness? Can we still get out there and be angry when we need to be angry, you know, and kind of reactionary when we need to be reactionary to whatever it might be, injustice, kind of, you know, the destruction of the natural world or whatever it might be? You know, we're not disabling ourselves, becoming too passive in a way.
In many ways you're more effective at anything you undertake because you're in presence and you're not adding anything to that. So often when we perform tasks, we're lost in our mind. You know, we're not necessarily present in what we're doing completely because our mind is going in a million different directions and we're following those thoughts. We're giving attention to those thoughts. It may be true that, so I would say that in my experience, you're much more effective at what you do. Things may fall away. In other words, you may choose not to give your attention or to perform certain tasks or do certain jobs simply because, you know, your interest in them has fallen away. But what you do will be done in presence, really without the addition of thoughts, which are really not necessary. So I would say your effectiveness actually goes up.
Yeah, because I know there are things we do every day that are so affected by our emotional attachment to them. And also that attachment gets connected to our identity. You know, you kind of become someone who, I'm not the kind of person who can face those kind of conversations, or I'm not the kind of person who answers the phone when I don't know the number, or, you know, a million different other permutations that we, you know, are driven by fear perhaps, or, you know, and it becomes almost paralyzing in our ability to get stuff done because I can't email that person because I know they'll want a conversation afterwards, or they'll, you know, be angry at me or whatever it is. And so we become less effective. You know, we don't want to rock the boat. And so our world becomes a little bit smaller. It sounds very, very stoic in a way. You know, the Stoics talked about the ego getting in the way and, you know, emotions being much too kind of influential, and, you know, we attach too much meaning to things when actually we need to just get on and get them done and deal with it. Is there a sense of that, or is it kind of almost like the antithesis of that, where, you know, the Stoics are much more about kind of powering forward without emotion, whereas this is much, much gentler way of going?
Yeah, it's you know, when recognition of self occurs, and when you know, when you abide as that and you recognize its nature, there just becomes this alignment process begins to occur, and it really begins to infiltrate the way you relate, the way you think, the way you feel, the way you relate, the way you interact. Actions happen spontaneously. Doing occurs, you know, but yeah, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not sure that stoicism or being stoic is the right way to put it. It's you're simply much more in line with what is, without adding you know, superfluous thought to it that, you know, doesn't need to be added. And this is not to say, by the way, that thinking is an issue. It's simply that thinking that arises on behalf of a sense of separation that must be discarded.
I mean, it sounds like an amazing release almost, you know, that suddenly you are here and it feels clean. You know what I mean? It feels like you've kind of shed all this kind of dirty stuff that's holding you back and weighing you down, all this kind of programming about, you know, I'm not good enough, or I could never do that, or the world is unfair and unjust. And actually it's more just a kind of sense of, well, here I am. Let's just go from that position, you know, and here I am and here the world is, and let's just kind of go to work, if you like.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the recognition certainly eliminates the recognition of your true nature as the still point, and the recognition of its qualities eliminates eliminates that smallness, if you will, as you were talking about. If anything, you know, the world is seen as a classroom. You know, the world, you recognize that the world is there because it's exactly what we need to wake up to this. You know, it's the catalyst that we need to wake up. So you stop judging the world, and in many ways, you know, you stop trying to change the world, because in reality, the recognition of self, when you recognize your being as the self-aware still point, it isn't a solitary recognition. It's recognized as the being of all. This is shared. This being is shared. You know, it's not my consciousness, my awareness, your consciousness. There aren't 7 billion unique separate consciousnesses. Consciousnesses. There's one awareness. So it, in a sense, it's a freedom for all in that recognition. And as a result of that, it's you're providing the greatest service that you can to humanity by coming to this recognition of self.
We talked about how kind of, you know, we are conditioned to kind of forget about this sense of, you know, who we are, who we came here to be. You know, we get all this baggage put on top of us, all the kind of cultural expectations and all that kind of stuff. Do you find that, you know, if you don't keep up a certain practice or whatever it is, that, you know, that can creep back in? I mean, do you have to kind of when you wake up in the morning, do you have to kind of just remind yourself to be aware? Or is it just something now that you just step into naturally every day?
When, you know, if it feels like a practice needs to be done, the practice should be done. In reality, there can't possibly be a practice to be what you already are, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's no path to the self. You are yourself, and you know, that's the reality. But the mind, the mind is very much tied up in externals. The mind is very much wed to identification with form, and not just the form of the body, but thought forms, you know, and our feelings and our emotions. So there, in truth, it isn't a practice. But if you feel that a practice should be made, you make that effort.
So maybe not so much a practice to kind of get to ourselves, but a practice of shedding all the kind of thoughts that are going on here that may kind of get in the way of the self or whatever it is. I mean, for you, yeah, is it something you just kind of wake up and you're just aware, you know, or is it something that you have to kind of sit down for a minute and kind of say, hang on a minute, all this, immediately my to-do list is popping into my head and that's causing me anxiety. Let me just take a moment to breathe here and just reconnect with what's
going on. Yeah, you know, we, for example, we don't have the ability to control our thoughts. You know, if ask anyone to sit down and, you know, close their eyes if they haven't meditated, let's say, and, you know, control their thoughts, you quickly find out you can't do that. But what power we do have is the power of attention. And that is whether we give our attention to thoughts or not. So, you know, it's a really a binary choice. Thoughts that arise on behalf of being a separate, isolated self, the ego mind, are thoughts that can be dismissed. You know, you simply don't attach to them. You don't give them attention. And in that case, so if you want to call that the practice, so to speak, this realignment practice, you don't give them attention. And eventually it's, again, you're withdrawing that energy from them. You know, you're not resisting them in any way, shape, or form. You completely let them be, but you simply don't follow them and give them attention. And they tend then to arise less and less over time. So, you know, these ideas of the, you know, the to-do list or psychological time idea, it's Monday and that means something. Over time, these begin to wash out and life really becomes concentrated in the now, living in the now. And, you know, whatever is necessary in terms, people hear that and they perhaps get a little concerned, whatever's necessary in terms of memory as needed, it's there when it's needed, but it's not referred to. You don't live in a constant referral to the past or worrying about the future.
Okay, so I mean, so you know that it's there, you know the future's there, you know you have things to do, but there's not this sense of, oh God, I've got things to do.
Yeah, no one has ever experienced anything other than now, you know, yeah. when we have thoughts about, you know, when we have memories, they're simply thoughts about the past we're having now. And the future never comes, it's now. And that's very clearly recognized. You know, the now and the sense of now and here is a great clue because it is the still point. It is the self-aware, you know, it is the self-aware still point. So yes, there's absolutely no concern, for example, when you perhaps meet a friend that you haven't, you know, seen for a year or two, anything that you need in that conversation is there. You don't lose that in any way, shape, or form. It's just that it's something that doesn't inform your now. It's not continually, you know, continually referred to.
Does it give you the ability to kind of find peace and kind of composure in any situation? So you could be there, you know, your wife is giving birth or your boss is kind of tearing a strip off you for, you know, you've handed in the report late or whatever. Does it give you the ability to just kind of compose yourself and just say, okay, this is happening now, and I'm going to respond to this situation in the most effective way possible, rather than going, oh my God, this is awful. What the hell's going on? Why is my boss being so angry at me? And, you know, my wife is here giving birth. My boss is on the phone. You know, it's all too much. Are you just much more capable of dealing with?
Yeah, there's still point. Your true nature is peace and happiness itself. That, you know, that is what you are. That is your nature. So the recognition that that is always with you, that is always available. And yes, it does. It tends to be, you know, at first it's perhaps as things get heated up and circumstances, you know, you can retreat to that. You can retreat to that which is always present, which is peace and happiness itself. And then over time, that peace and happiness just begins to permeate, you know, it takes hold, so to speak, and it truly permeates all experience. It doesn't mean that you won't occasionally get pulled away from it. It doesn't mean that you occasionally won't, you know, react in a way that isn't consistent with it, but you will recognize this much more quickly and you know, realign yourself to it very quickly.
Jung, I'm quite interested in Carl Jung. He talked a lot about dipping beneath the ego and some of the kind of voices we can hear, if you like, or the messages we get from our kind of more subconscious self. When you are kind of in the still point, do you ever find a kind of a perspective on reality or a perspective on yourself or even kind of ideas of how to be in the world that you would not necessarily have received had you still been kind of caught up in all the emotions and all the inputs? You know, do you ever kind of find a kind of wiser, deeper wisdom within yourself that you hadn't noticed before?
This still points to the seat of true wisdom and true intelligence. And you know, when you abide in and as the still point, it's when you have access to that true font of intelligent infinity. Yes.
And I mean, does that give you, I mean, is it still all of these things? I think if I was to kind of connect with my still point and be in that still point, I probably wouldn't want to even function in the material world anymore. I'd probably be like, this is where I am. and this is quite nice. And, you know, I'm aware of everything that's going on around me. And I'm just going to stay here. I'm just going to stay in this position. I'm, you know, sat here in my chair, and I don't need to go anywhere else. You know, I don't need to be involved in life anymore. I'm quite happy, thank you. You know, how do we keep turning up?
No, you know, it's you know, in Zen, the you know, in Zen, there's this. They talk about how at first, you know, the mountains are mountains, the rivers are rivers, and then the mountains are not mountains, the rivers are not rivers. You know, denoting that period in a sense. But then the mountains become mountains, and the rivers become rivers again. And that is this really this reintegration of experience, reintegrating experience with this kind of newfound understanding. And I think that that's. You know, that's really, really the case is, you know, if anything, it's, you know, life is lived in a much more appreciative and dynamic way because of that. It's not that you, you know, simply want to, you know, sit in the corner and, you know, just kind of avoid experience. At least that's not my experience. You know, without a doubt, for many folks, that, and it was in fact the case for me again, in turning away from the world for a while and really truly eventually reintegrating everything, including the way that that I, you know, interact with others. But that is something that comes as a natural process of this as well.
There's the old saying, isn't there, that, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. You know, you have to carry on and continue doing that.
That's right.
When you kind of went, you turned away from the world, you kind of had this, I don't want to call it a discovery, but you kind of found something that you'd always had all along, and then you reintegrated. Did you find that the world responded to you differently afterwards, or was that just kind of irrelevant now?
I think that the answer in many ways is yes. When you begin to treat the world as, you know, with this recognition of the unity, so to speak, and the fact that it's nothing but this consciousness in vibration, you know, many things happen. And, you know, I as an example, your relationships improve, you know, across the board. And I think that, you know, it may not always be the case that everyone else feels that way, but certainly you've kind of, healed those relationships. It's different. You know, I'm sure it's absolutely different for everyone. So I can really only speak, you know, from my own experience. But the world, your true ability is to determine how you can't change what's on the screen of the world. You get to change how you react to it. And that's the real power that you have. But seemingly then there are things that, you know, that change. When you stop fighting the world, it stops fighting back.
Yeah, I kind of have a saying that I throw out into some of my conversations. You know, when you step up to life, life steps up to meet you. And it kind of mirrors the energy that you bring to the world. And if you go into the world looking for conflict, then you're going to find conflict. But if you go in with a kind of peaceful approach and an open approach, then that's kind of the same response you get back. The subtitle of the book is the Simplicity of Spiritual Enlightenment. Is it something, you know, have you put things in there, steps that people can take to kind of go on their own journey to shed all the things that they are not in order to find who they really are? You know, is there a kind of a sort of, you know, some guidelines that people can follow to get the ball rolling?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the it's titled The Simplicity of Spiritual Enlightenment because what can be more simple than simply being what you already always are and cannot not be? So that's pretty simple. You know, I think that probably more times than anything in the book is this simple directing people back to their own awareness, their own aware being. You know, it's before you have to have this recognition of self before self-realization can occur for the most part, you know, for most folks. It has to be this recognition of self and then this abiding in and as that which you already are. And, you know, we access it simply by asking ourselves, am I aware? And, you know, eventually you don't need to ask that question, but certainly for those who are beginning, you know, this or are, you know, moving towards this, that's very, very helpful. And then taking that time to recognize that, abide as that, and then contemplate, you know, you begin to get a little bit of separation between that which is the unmanifest self, your true nature, and your thoughts and your feelings and everything that arises from that. And then that can be exploited. Then that can be, you can abide in and as yourself, and you can begin to see those distinctions more and more clearly over time.
Can you use it as a kind of tool for self-mastery? So, you know, I'm overweight. I know I need to go out and do more exercise. I don't like going and doing exercise, but I'm aware that I don't like it, but I'm going to go and do it anyway. You know, you talked about becoming much more effective. Can you use it to become, you know, a better version of yourself, someone who is, you know, more tolerant or more disciplined or that kind of thing?
Yeah. This recognition is kind of the cure for a lot of things, but the recognition has to come, you know, has to happen. And, you know, people will ask about diet or that. This is the ultimate, the recognition is the ultimate, you know, in a very real way, that it takes care of itself. It takes care of itself once we recognize and abide over and over and begin to realign. Our life becomes realigned with that. So yes,
there is there's a quote. I hope you don't mind if I just Google it very, very, very quickly. It's from Anton Chekhov, I've saved it here on my phone. So I'm just going to dig it out because it really resonated with me for a minute. And if I can find it here, and he talks about only during hard times do people come to understand how difficult it is to be the master of their feelings and their thoughts. You know, is it that, you know, say your pain point, if you like, and I think for a lot of people, these kind of transformational experiences through their lives come from a kind of pain point. You know, I don't want things to be like this anymore. But say one of your weaknesses is alcohol or something like that. And, you know, you're doing really well, you're feeling rested, you're very much kind of abiding in this kind of still point and being aware. But then you have a terrible week and, you know, everything starts to fall apart. You know, you've lost your job, you know, whatever it is, or you're just very, very tired, you've been ill, something like that. And then you just want to drink, and you're like, I'm aware that I want to drink, but I want to drink. So is it something that is it like a fair weather kind of sense of being, that when things are going well, it's very easy to be in this kind of still point of awareness, or is it something that's harder to do when things aren't quite going your way and you're tired and your defenses are down, if you like?
Yeah, it's true that especially during the earlier stages of this realignment process, things like unusual circumstances in the world, difficult circumstances in the world, body illness, things like that can tend to pull you back into this egoic identification. And with time, really immersing yourself in and as the still point, that even, you know, those circumstances begin to align as well, so that things get a little harder and, you know, you find, well, you didn't lose your peace and your happiness. You didn't go into experience so much that, you know, you, um, you lost it. So yeah, it is absolutely true that particularly in the early stages, and you know that the time of all this, every mind is configured differently, so it's different for everyone. But yes, there's no question about that. And yet the approach is the same. It's this continual referring to what is it that knows this experience, and then you know abiding as that.
There's a poem or a few lines by Rumi, the Sufi poet, and he said, "These pains you feel are messengers. Listen to them." This when you're in this kind of still point of awareness, and you're having feelings, you're reacting to certain stimuli, but you're aware of it. Are you able to use kind of these kind of emotions rather than just being in the emotions, but you use them as kind of signposts, if you like, to say, oh, hang on a minute, I'm feeling this way about this situation. I can use this to, you know, steer myself in a different direction, or to, you know, be careful with my responses, or to, you know, better know myself and be, you know, a kind of master of myself.
Yeah. And, you know, it, your sadhana is anything that's, you know, if something truly bothers you, then that's your sadhana. That's something that you definitely should look at. And without a doubt, you know, in the book, I talk pretty extensively about the very high value of when one is sitting and maybe has very intense emotions and sensations within the body. You know, if we have fear, we have anxiety, you know, there are sensations associated with that, and there are thoughts that go along with that. This idea of removing thinking from that process, severing the thought, and sitting with the raw sensations in the field of awareness, and not labeling them, but sitting with them, bringing them very, very close. This is something that's very, 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 very important. Typically what happens is we engage our mind and we engage thoughts. And at that point, we're kind of lost, because now we're deeply into a conditioned set of beliefs and systems already. And we're into the fear, we're into the anxiety, wherever it might be. But as we practice this, we get to the point where we can suspend our thought and sit with the raw sensation. And as a great non-dual teacher called Jean Klein, who said, you know, this is a very high art, and it is, it's a very high art, because it brings us to the recognition when we do this of the fact that the only true substance of these sensations, the only substance of this fear, is ultimately the love underneath it.
That's really quite powerful. I was thinking there for a moment about the power of language, because you're right, we do label everything. Everything becomes based on words. You know, we sit there in quiet contemplation, but it's just words coming over and over again in our heads. And, you know, there is that, the words become a kind of shorthand for the feelings and for the sensations, but they're not the sensations. They're a kind of a really diminished version of the sensations. But when you strip that away, what you're getting is so much more, it was deeper, it's more textured, it's more kind of visceral. I mean, is that kind of, you know, we talk about the void and don't stare into the void, and I can imagine this can be quite intimidating for some people, to just the idea of doing this, of kind of letting go of the ego and just unleashing who we might be underneath it from a kind of real feeling, you know, sensational kind of aspect. Can it be scary? Yeah. Can it be frightening?
Well, you know, it's the only, you know, the fear comes from the mind alone. You know, the mind is you know, seemingly, you know, creating that. There's this, you know, this great quote from the Christian mystic, Saint John of the Cross. I think I put it in the book. If a person wants to be sure of the road on which they tread, they must close their eyes and walk in the dark. And of course, he wrote about, you know, the dark night of the soul. So that is a period, and that is something that has to be moved through. This sense of nothingness, this sense of void, if you will. The still point is not nothing. You know, we can call it a pregnant emptiness. It's fullness in potential. It is certainly not nothing, but to the mind, you know, the mind which tries to hold on, the ego mind which tries to hold on desperately to its own identity, it intuits something greater than itself, but it cannot intellectualize it or understand it in any way, and that creates the sense of fear. So, you know, that part of the journey takes courage to move through.
I've known people who have tried something like meditation, but just really, you know, brought back terrible memories and, you know, all these kind of traumatic experiences that they kind of pushed down for a long time. Do you think that you have to kind of deal with this stuff and kind of travel down that kind of crowded road of all your bad experiences, all your bad memories, your shame, your guilt, the injustice that has been kind of put upon you, and travel through that in order to reach this point and just be kind of done with all of that? And then
what you have to do is to recognize your true nature. You have to recognize the self-aware still point. You have to recognize the fact that it doesn't come and go, that it is ever present. It is not bound to birth or death. You are, you know, you were not born. You will not die. You know, that is critical. It's critical to recognize that it is shared, meaning it has no borders. It's limitless, so it has no lack. There is no question that that light, if you will, the light of the self, anything that is brought to that, whether they are, you know, thoughts, memories, and any of these things, when they are brought to the truth, it will dispel them. You know, it will dispel them, but they have to be looked at. You know, with any of these things, we can't learn, you know, we can't live without anxiety until we learn to live with it. We learn to look at it. And this is what we were just talking about when we mentioned the fact that, you know, you can decouple the thinking aspect from the sensation aspect of all of these traumas and, you know, memory, any of these. Ultimately, we're dealing with fear. We're dealing with, we can boil this all down right to fear. And when we practice that high art of decoupling thought from it, and we sit and we bring those sensations close, we do not push them down, we do not turn away from them. When we have the courage to sit with them, they will reveal themselves as nothing but their source, which is love.
Yeah, that's really powerful. There's a another quote. I'm all about quotes, but Joseph Campbell said that, you know, the treasure that you seek is in the cave you fear to enter, or something like that. The cave that you fear to enter holds the treasure that you seek. And it's, you know, it's so true. You know, this notion of fear is much more powerful than the thing we're actually afraid of. You know, once we see the thing we're afraid of, half the time it just evaporates into nothing, you know, that kind of thing. Well, that's really quite a powerful conversation. There's a lot here that I'm, you know, need to kind of delve into further, I think. So I'm going to have to go away and get the book, because there is so much here. There's kind of, we talked about Zen. It feels like there's a sort of touch of Taoism in this. There's a little bit of everything, but ultimately it's just a kind of, I think, a kind of release from everything we're not, in order to kind of find, you know, who we really are, who we truly are, and that kind of light, if you like. And it's something that I'm quite eager to experience myself and just to get into it. If people want to find out more about your ideas, your writing, your book, where can they go to dig into that?
Yeah, so the book, The Still Point, will be released on March 1st. You know, hardcover initially, an audiobook, Amazon. It's available for pre-order at Amazon.com now, and other outlets as well. There's a website, authorkevinkranitsky.com. So should be, you know, relatively widely available March 1st.
And you talked about this as part of a kind of, we're in the middle of the biggest wave of self-realization that the kind of world has ever seen. Do you think it's authentic self-realization, or do you think it's kind of, do you think there is a genuine you know, revolution, spiritual revolution going on right now? Or do you think it's something else?
I do. I intuit that, you know, I can only speak to the level of intuition, but I intuit from what I feel and what I see that it is a genuine movement across the planet. And of course, you know, every mind is at a different place. Every mind is, you know, is in its own, you know, it has its own time, you know, to wake up. So certainly there are many levels of it, but in general, I see it as a very significant step forward for humanity. And in fact, it's simply because it's necessary. You know, we've reached the end of the alternatives, unfortunately. So
before we go, just you talked about the environment. Do you think aligning with our true selves also requires a certain alignment with the planet, with nature, with, you know, do you think that they are part of the same thing?
It's unquestionable. When we recognize, you know, we live as fragments, as isolated, the belief in being isolated, separate fragments with the ego mind, everything is then other than us. And that doesn't only include other people or animals, it includes the planet as well. When you see and you recognize consciousness as what it is, which is a unified whole, then everything changes in that regard. So yes, it's the only way ultimately that the outward projection of the world really can change in a true and meaningful and lasting way is for humanity in a much more significant number to wake up to the recognition of their unified being.
And do you think this is something we're going to see in our lifetime? Or do you think it could be 1,000 lifetimes before we see this happening?
Well, you know, the most important thing, Chris, that I say to everyone is this is a revolution of one.
Yeah.
You know, you are responsible for you. And no matter what, no one can imprint this on anyone. Everyone can recognize their true nature themselves. So that's really all we can do. It doesn't matter what the state of the outside world looks like, whether the outside world was, you know, seemingly perfect or whether it's flawed, we still have responsibility to change our mind and to recognize what we are ourselves. And that's all we can do. And that's all we need to do ultimately as well.
Perfect. Well, I will end on that note. I think it's a great kind of call to action, if you like.
A radical call to inaction, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much for that. I will put all the links and everything in the show notes. But thank you so much for your time. My mind is boggled, but I'm going to go away and digest this. So I'm very, very grateful.
Pleasure.
So there you go. That was Kevin Krinitsky giving up his time to share with me ideas about the still point. And I think it's a brilliant idea. Just let go of everything you know or you don't know to be absolutely true. And most of these things are connected to our emotional states. They're connected to all the kind of stories we create between the facts of what we know for sure. And I've already started doing this. I found it to be quite a powerful thing. Fear has been a dominant player in my life for a very, very long time. And so just these last couple of weeks since I'm having this conversation, I've decided to stop the fears, just drop it. And I've been finding it much more effective way of getting stuff done. So thank you to Kevin for that. So as I previously mentioned, you can find out more about The Still Point and Kevin at his website, authorkevinkrinitsky.com. And you can find out about more episodes of this podcast at the website, which is www.conversationsonliving.com, where you'll find out about me, my writing, my books, and there are meditations on there, and yeah, lots of interesting stuff. So check it out, sign up to the newsletter, and don't forget to rate, review, subscribe to Conversations on Living, the podcast. Check out our Facebook group, just search Conversations on Living, and carry on the conversation there if you like. Next week, I'm going to be talking to Chris Plord. Chris is a conscious performance coach, and we're going to be talking about how we can just basically make our lives better, richer, more textured, and really help ourselves to get unstuck and live the life we love. So check out that one. That'll be next week, Chris Plord. But in the meantime, have a lovely day.